You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jelani Cobb says that the most amazing thing about the 2008 election is not that a black man won his party's nomination, but that he did so without the support of most of the longtime black political leadership. Dr. Cobb, who's an associate professor of history at Spelman College, examines this and other phenomena of the Obama candidacy in his book, The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress, which is published by Walker & Company. Listeners told us how much they enjoyed the interview, so we thought we'd air it again on this Labor Day holiday. Dr. Cobb points out in his book that Jesse Jackson, John Lewis, and Andrew Young, who are the civil rights old guard in this country, supported Hillary Clinton in the election. So I began the interview by asking him, why didn't they support Barack Obama?
Well, one of the interesting things that happened during the spring of 2008 was that I got a chance to talk with some of these people, and there was a wide array of reasons. Some people said that they had, you know, sincere belief that Hillary Clinton was the best person, and, you know, perfectly welcome to make those kinds of decisions. But on the other side of it, there was also a kind of sub-theme in which Barack Obama seemed to have upset the apple cart, meaning that there was a traditional business model in which black leadership gained its authority by its ability to direct black voters to their particular, you know, white patrons. And Barack Obama certainly presented a challenge to that kind of way of doing business.
Were they separating Hillary from Bill? Weren't any black leaders disappointed in the way that President Clinton handled the Lottie Guinier and Joycelyn Elder's situations, the fact that he totally ignored some of the tragedies of Africa, most notably the Rwandan genocide?
Well, I think that was what was so cynical about it, was that I don't know that people were necessarily I don't want to make a broad statement, but I don't know that all of these individuals were necessarily motivated by the issues, but more so by their own particular political interests.
Because there were two issues that hurt Hillary Clinton with many Democrats. Her role in the failure of the health care bill during the Clinton years, and also her vote for the war in Iraq. Right. And many of those black leaders were opposed to that war, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. But they were also, there was an alternate kind of storyline in which, you know, for instance, Maxine Waters, who supported Hillary Clinton, pointed out that during the Clinton administration, she was able to get the first specific funding targeting African-American communities for anti-HIV work. And, you know, they talked about these kinds of longstanding transactional relationships and ties that they had with the Clintons. And so there were some people who had, you know, principled reasons for this. I just don't think that was necessarily the entire story.
Was there an element of believing that Obama could never win, that they just wanted to back a winner?
Well, I think that after that was a storyline up until Iowa. And after Iowa, and especially certainly after Super Tuesday, it became clear that he had a very good shot at winning. And, you know, I don't think that was necessarily an argument that could have been used then.
What about the fact that they were the old guard and there might be some sense of competition that an Obama presidency would knock them out of their leadership position?
I think that was exactly
or undermine them.
I think that was exactly the concern, because it's a kind of pragmatic question. If your job has always been to represent the interests of a particular community to the highest authorities in the land, what do you do when the highest authority is in fact part of that community? You no longer have a brokerage position.
And then there's the whole matter of generation, obviously. Mm-hmm. Obama seemed more attractive to the younger voters as opposed to the old guard civil rights leaders like John Lewis, who is in his 70s now.
Right, right. Well, what was kind of fascinating about that was that John Lewis, who very, courageously, went to the bridge in Selma where he was, beaten and had his skull fractured, He did this in the name of gaining equal access to the ballot box, you know, across, you know, racial lines in this country. Yet his, you know, support for Hillary Clinton was at odds with his congressional district, which was something like 70% favoring Barack Obama. And he actually wound up having to deal with a protest which was spearheaded by a woman by the name of Malaika Moses. Malaika Moses is the daughter of Bob Moses, who everyone knows from the, you know, Freedom Summer and the tremendous work. So it was a very clear generational dynamic there. And, you know, the other thing that I would say is that, and we have, you know, something that can sometimes resemble a machine, you know, kind of a black political machine, as, you know, maybe the last of the ethnic, you know, machines in American politics. And, you know, those machines tended to work well as long as the group that they were representing had a kind of monolithic set of interests. When those interests began to diversify, it's much harder to, you know, to maintain control.
You said that most of the black voters in John Lewis's district were supporting Obama. What was, well, you were living in Atlanta at the time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What was the general feeling? Did we look at the polls? Was there a generational split? Because I remember when Clinton was president, some people called him the first black president.
Right, and people took a great deal of offense to that as well. But yeah, there was certainly a generational dynamic. I remember being at, of all places, Ebenezer Baptist Church, which is the church where Martin Luther King pastored, and there was a younger person who said, you know, these people think that unless you were beaten in a civil rights march, you don't know anything about being black. And that was the general sentiment as it related to kind of the established leadership.
On the other hand, some of the younger voters, for them, racial segregation was just something they'd read about, not mm-hmm. lived through.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was more of a theoretical thing.
Well, yeah, I think there is. But we've also had, you know, kind of firsthand experience with, you know, lots of the racial, ongoing racial concerns. We were talking about, you know, incarceration. We were talking about police brutality or, you know, economic inequality. So it's not as if these issues are something that can only be understood, you know, by visiting the Civil Rights Museum. We've had our own kind of experience with the thorny issues of race in the United States. And so on some level, people began to believe that the Civil Rights Movement had become a kind of cynical card that could be played in order to give someone the moral upper hand as leadership.
My guest is William Jelani Cobb. His book, The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress, it's published by Walker. Well, let's talk a bit about Jesse Jackson, who
sure.
probably came out of this most wounded.
Right.
Why? Why? I mean, here's a man who, I guess, he called himself the president of black America.
Right.
So did he see this as a challenge to his leadership?
I think he certainly did. And when we heard the, you know, the castration comment that he made during the summer of 2008, most of us were just stunned because, you know, we'd been suspicious of kind of the, you know, the way that Jackson spoke about Obama during the 2008 election. On the one hand, he endorsed him, and then he publicly criticized him. We all know that you don't publicly criticize people when you endorse them, after you endorse them, generally speaking, as a rule in politics.
Well, they both come from Chicago.
Yeah.
They have similar connections. And his son, Jesse Jackson Jr., was supporting Barack Obama without right. criticizing him.
Right, right. And, you know, one thing I will say in Jesse Jackson's defense, however, Jesse Jackson Sr., he did more than any of those that generation opened the door for a Barack Obama presidency with his 1988 presidential campaign. And one of the really egregious oversights in 2008 was the fact that there was no major media story about that. There were no big magazine articles about that. And he did have reason to believe that he'd been overlooked in some ways.
Did Barack Obama not reach out to him enough?
Well, I don't know if that was Barack Obama's place. He was running a different kind of campaign in a different different
but
era.
But you still pay respect to your elders.
Yeah, I think so. But I don't think there was necessarily anything that was a slight from the Obama campaign, so much as I think that there was this, you know, amazing historic figure and this amazing historic race that happened in 1988 that people seem to have completely forgotten. And I'll give you an example. When Barack Obama won in Iowa, everyone went on, and the storyline was, you know, things have changed. An African American has won in a state where there's less than 5% black population, less than 4% black population, as if that had never happened. In 1988, Jesse Jackson won in Vermont, which has an even smaller black population than Iowa does. And so there was kind of reason to believe that, you know, he'd been overlooked, or kind of relegated to the trash bin of history.
The subtitle of your book is The Paradox of Progress. Mm-hmm. What's paradoxical here?
Well, I think that we always thought that if such a fantastic thing as a African-American presidency could ever occur, it would happen after we had resolved all the, you know, major issues of race in this country. But yet we look at it and we're able to have, you know, these disparate realities of, you know, these this wonderful fact that I believe it was 51 million white Americans voted for a black candidate. And at the same time, we have unemployment among black college-educated people being double what it is among white college-educated people.
Well, some people have argued that George W. Bush made it possible for Barack Obama to become president, and also John McCain, who did rather poorly in the debates. In his 2004 speech at the Democratic Convention, Obama said, there's not a black America or a white America, there's a United States of America. That's the sort of thing that a black candidate has to say to get elected.
That's true. That is the kind of thing that a black candidate has to say, but it wasn't true. And it was kind of political boilerplate, and, you know, it was idealism, and, you know, we really love idealism in America.
The same sort of thing that a Republican or a Democrat would say, I'm not just the representative of my party.
Right.
I'm the representative of all the people once I'm elected.
Or I guess the best is, you know, I want to get away from partisanship. And so, I mean, there are all these things that politicians say that are wonderful, but they're not really true, and we don't really take them on face value. But as it relates to George W. Bush, we've had terrible presidencies before, but they haven't necessarily opened the door for an African-American to reach the position that they've reached. Something had to change in the country in order for us to be able to react to the George Bush presidency in the way that we did and be open to someone like Barack Obama.
So what do you think that was? You were an Obama delegate from Georgia in the convention, weren't you?
Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's any one thing that happened. I think it's the culmination of, you know, the kind of tide of things that's happened since the 1964 Civil Rights Act, you know, with the numbers of people who now work, you know, with someone of a different race, with American popular culture, with, you know, music and, you know, television. We've gradually gotten past some of the social barriers of race, even if we are still dealing with kind of the economic questions and the public policy questions of race.
There were a lot of comparisons drawn between Obama and Abraham Lincoln during the campaign. We don't hear them anymore. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think there were the easy comparisons, you know, the both of them being tall, slender lawyers from Illinois who served in the state legislature there, and, you know, both of them having, on some way or another, a kind of historic relationship to race in America. And, you know, well, the thing is, I remember George W. Bush compared himself to Abraham Lincoln because, you know, we had two wars that were going on. And, you know, Jimmy Carter compared himself to Abraham Lincoln. Pretty much everyone compares themselves to Abraham Lincoln. And in the case of Obama, it was more resonant than others. But, you know, that's pretty much a standard comparison.
Well, I promise if I ever run for office, I'll compare myself to James Knox Polk. My guest is William Jelani Cobb, who's associate professor and chair of history at Spelman College, specializing in post-Civil War African-American history, 20th century American politics, and the history of the Cold War. His book, The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress, is published by Walker. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with an interview from July with historian William Jelani Cobb. His book, The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress, is published by Walker & Company. I asked Dr. Cobb, do you think that Barack Obama's malleability has helped him or hurt him? He seems like he can fit in whether he's talking to a mostly white or a mostly black crowd.
I think that there's been a kind of paradox about that. There was during the campaign, there was a kaleidoscope effect with him. People could look at him and see what they wanted to see. There were people across racial, social, political spectrums that could find something in common with him. But there's a kind of paradoxical, you know, nature to that, which is that a wide array of people had bought in, so to speak, you know, to the campaign and felt a degree of ownership and investment. So that when he actually took office, it was almost an unwieldy coalition from the beginning. And so I think that the decline, the rapid decline we saw in his poll numbers was a function of the fact that he had such an incredibly broad array of people who were interested in the first place.
And there was a sense of promise. He famously brought in a lot of new voters. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming many of them are disillusioned, especially right. if they're not working right now.
Yeah, and I think those are people who wanted the kind of quick payoff. And when we look at the kind of condition that the country was in when President Obama took office, I think that all told, the administration hasn't done a bad job since then. But, you know, they're facing some things that are pretty difficult and intractable.
Well, there are a lot of people on the left who are mm-hmm. disappointed. They expected him to be more liberal. And one of the reasons they voted for him was they thought he was more liberal than Hillary Clinton.
Right. Well, the thing that is interesting about this, again, I think it goes back to the kaleidoscope, effect, which is if we looked at what Barack Obama said in The Audacity of Hope, it's pretty clear he's a centrist Democrat.
If you read some of the email I get.
Well, I think if we hear some of the conversations
he studied at the feet of Stalin, Marx, and Engels.
Well, can I tell you a quick story? I just came back from Moscow. I taught there for a semester as a Fulbright scholar at Moscow State University. And one day, one of the students came up to me and was just kind of very delicately trying to broach the subject and said, Professor, is it true that the people in the United States call Barack Obama a Marxist? And I said, yes, it's true. There are some people who have said that he's a Marxist. Then he was even kind of more delicate in his phrasing, but he said, I think perhaps they do not know anything about Marxism. Mm. and I thought that was kind of hilarious because he was saying, you know, in Russia we know Marxists, and this guy is not one, you know.
But do they make connections with some of the racism and the other prejudices that have been so part of the Russian experience?
In terms of how things are?
Because they still, maybe not this younger generation, but during all the Soviet years, you would have thought the United States still had slavery.
Right. Well, that's what was interesting being there, because people have what they know of America does not comport with it being a nation that was prepared to elect a black president. And so half of the time that I was there, I was, you know, fielding questions about how this could happen, because they didn't know anything beyond kind of Jim Crow, slavery, racism, assassination of Martin Luther King. And those were the things that were most notably kind of seen about race in the United States, even as there are, you know, as you mentioned, kind of, you know, racial problems in Russia itself.
We talked earlier about how the older generation saw him as a young upstart, perhaps not mm-hmm. as experienced as he should be. But one of the criticisms also was kind of floated around, although not in the nicest way, was that Barack Obama wasn't black enough.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I thought that was kind of a canard, because there was never anything empirical about that. I think there was more of a media storyline than it was an actual kind of political reality. What I do think was the case is that people didn't know him very well. So when I interviewed for the book one of the people who ran the South Carolina campaign, and they talked about in the 2007 going to community after community after community in South Carolina where there were lots of black people who didn't even know he was African American. And so they started putting up pictures of him with his wife, pictures of him and his family, and so that people would know indeed who this person was. But I don't think that, you know, black voters were really particularly concerned about that.
Although Michelle Obama is credited in some circles
right.
with making him a little blacker as a candidate?
Certainly making him a little more familiar. Mm-hmm. His storyline was an odd one. You know, okay, you're Kansan and Kenyan, but you grew up in Hawaii and Indonesia, and you know, but Michelle Obama was a very familiar figure in communities. We know someone like her, or we have a cousin like her, or you know, there's someone we grew up with in the neighborhood who reminds us of her, and she did, in some ways, open those doors for him.
After he was elected, people were throwing around the term post-racial.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your thoughts about the term post-racial?
Well, you know, I pointed this out at the time, which is that, you know, from where I stand, the most influential president of the 20th century was Franklin Roosevelt, who led the country through the Great Depression and World War II from a wheelchair. Yet, 45 years after his death, we still had to pass the Americans with Disabilities Act because there was discrimination. There wasn't complete equality for people who had disabilities. I don't think, you know, we should necessarily take it as a given that the success of one person within a group represents the complete transcendence for everyone in that group.
On the other hand, a lot of people are suggesting that this has opened up racial lines, mm-hmm. That people are a lot more open in statements about race than they might have been in the past. Are you surprised by how everyone has been pussyfooting around the matter of whether certain elements of the Tea Party movement are racist? Even Benjamin Jealous of the NAACP has done some backtracking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think that people were it took a long time to actually bring these things to the foreground. Perhaps there was a recognition that once we get into, you know, conversations about race in this country, the decibel level tends to rise, and it tends to be very difficult for us to have substantive exchanges. And there are lots of other issues on the table. And I don't think anyone wanted to make it more difficult for President Obama. At the same time, I think that some of these elements within the Tea Party clearly have behaved in ways that are racist and that needed to be challenged.
Well, as a talk show host, I receive an awful lot of requests to put guests on from across the political spectrum. And there's a fair number of stuff that comes in suggesting that Barack Obama is now skewing the judicial system toward favoritism for blacks, mm-hmm. for example. Glenn Beck has been saying mm-hmm. something similar on his radio and television shows, and Rush Limbaugh and others. So there is a feeling that he is trying to either redress the imbalance of the past or skew things in a way that some people might find unacceptable.
Well, what I think is this. We have the data that, you know, for a African American, you're more likely to, on every level of the kind of criminal justice system, if you set foot in a courtroom, you're more likely to be convicted. You're more likely to have serious charges brought against you. If you are convicted of the same crime as a white person, you're more likely to serve a longer sentence and so on. So these are really issues of disparities. And, you know, I think that Eric Holder, the Attorney General Eric Holder, was correct in saying that we should have equal justice, you know, for that, saying that we should somehow or another go light on someone who commits an offense, but certainly someone who does something wrong should not be penalized more harshly than a person of another race who commits the same wrong.
My guest is William Jelani Cobb, who is an associate professor and chair of history at Spelman College. He's written a book called The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. It's published by Walker & Company. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. You write very briefly about your father in the mm-hmm. book. How was his life experience different from yours?
Well, I served as a delegate in 2008 to the Democratic Convention, representing the 5th Congressional District in Georgia. My father grew up in a small town called Hazelhurst, Georgia, and one of the reasons that he left Georgia and came to New York was because there were no opportunities. And at that point, if he'd attempted to vote when he was a young man, he could well have been killed. And so in looking at the Democratic Convention, I had to remark upon this, you know, amazing turn of events where I represent not only, you know, his state, but at a convention, but I represent his state in a convention that nominates a black person for the presidency. And I thought that was a good way of kind of summing up, you know, what that election meant on both a personal level and on a historic kind of level.
What about your students at Spelman? Mm-hmm. Do they come in well-educated about the history of slavery and everything mm-hmm. that followed? Do they understand what happened with Reconstruction, what happened during the Civil Rights Movement?
Well, you know, that's one of my jobs as a history professor, to make sure they understand these things.
But they might have been more aware of them even before they came to school in a previous generation, in fact, your generation. Mm-hmm.
Well, no, I think that there are young people who come in with, you know, kind of a base working knowledge, generally speaking, kind of a base working knowledge, you know, of these themes and some ideas of maybe how race has worked in the country historically. And you know, we do our best to kind of make sure we add, you know, degrees of information to that.
And your sense is that they are pretty sophisticated?
Well, yeah, I would say so, yeah.
You have a blog you call American Exception. Why right. that name?
Well, for two reasons. One is the idea of American exceptionalism has always interested me in American history and American public policy, but also because, you know, there was this idea of American exception as in, you know, the group of people who have been an exception to America's kind of democratic bounty. And that is, you know, not only African Americans, but I was talking most, you know, prominently about African Americans. So it was both American exceptionalism and, you know, the exceptions to America. So that was why I named it that.
I want to get back to something you said earlier, that it was clear from the start, from his book and pretty much everything he said, that Barack Obama is very much a middle-of-the-road political figure. And yet he has become such a polarizing
right.
figure. Would you say that's simply a matter of race?
No.
Or do you think that no matter who came in as a Democrat, mm-hmm. because I remember when Bill Clinton, who was a rather centrist Democrat,
right.
when he came in, I read a letter to the Wall Street Journal saying that this was the most leftist
right.
Democrat since George McGovern, I think is
right.
what they said. But they could just as easily have compared him to some socialist as they're doing today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Eugene Debs. well, I think that I don't think this is entirely about race. I think that, you know, race is a maybe a plurality in this equation, but we don't know what the totality of it is. But we saw even that prior, we saw it with Jimmy Carter. We saw the John Birch Society and their assaults on John F. Kennedy.
Well, Dwight D. Eisenhower, they said, was working for the communists.
Right. There's this kind of strand of American paranoia that goes even back to Franklin Roosevelt, where people said that he was a socialist, a communist.
So why doesn't it get dismissed? Because it's there. It's a front page story in the New York Times on a regular
mm-hmm,
basis.
Mm-hmm. I think that goes, you know, very deep in American history. It goes back to the concerns that the Tories were going to take over and, you know, reassert British dominion after the American Revolution. I think it's a theme that is possibly one of the most resonant in American history and American politics. And I will say this, you know, also, Barack Obama was campaigning on the idea of change, that he, you know, wanted significant change, and he also wanted bipartisanship. And historically speaking, those two things have pretty much been mutually exclusive. When we look at the most notable legislation, you know, of the 20th century, whether that is the Wagner Act, the Civil Rights Act, the Reagan tax cuts, you know, these were things that were immensely divisive, and, you know, they were done, you know, largely along partisan lines, even if they wound up being Medicare, you know, for instance, if they wound up being popular much later. They stirred a great deal of controversy at the time.
When after the election, we were reading that this was one of the most significant elections in the history of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now all we're talking about is whether the Democrats can hold on during the midterm elections.
Right.
So are we back to politics as usual, or do you think that we're still living through exceptional times?
I think we're living through exceptional times, but there's a dynamic, one of the reasons why I like history, which is that we never tend to notice the exceptional nature of the times until after they're over. If we were going to the 1920s, I don't think people would necessarily thought the times were roaring, you know, at that time.
You've also written about the Cold War, and just for a moment, what are your thoughts about these spy cases?
I sent a email to one of my Russian friends after the, you know, story broke, and I said, I thought our countries were buddies now. Our presidents had hamburgers I was like, is this any way to treat a friend? You know, but, you know, generally speaking, I think this is, you know, kind of, you know, this is, we know that this happens, and, you know, we still are, you know, engaged in these kinds of things in international relations. And maybe people don't have quite the skill set that they once had during the Cold War. And that's why these things appear to be as sloppy as they were.
William Jelani Cobb is the author of a number of books. He also has been a featured commentator at NPR, CNN. He was in the acclaimed documentary Beyond Beats and Rhymes. And his latest book is called The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. It's published by Walker & Company. My great thanks to you, William Jelani Cobb, for being here.
Thank you.